It's a little ironic that you would use someone shot full of pride to talk about humility. Such is your grace that we're always trying to talk about you and we're always over our head. Pray that your Spirit would provide what's needed and that you would bring, in coincidence, people's personal experiences against the truths we're talking about. Amen. So roughly quarterly, the counseling department tries to host what we call leaders enhancement sessions. These materials are on the web, and so if you're ever interested in getting enhanced, if you go to counseling resources on the Xenos website, click on the tab which is related to workshops, you'll see a lot of different teachings on dealing with shame, on forgiveness, I don't have them all in my head. But there's a lot there, and this will be on there as well. It looks like we have enough paper for everyone, but if you didn't happen to get any paper, all that material will be there as well after this. What we're interested in, just in general, is getting ideas from you. Certainly feedback on what we've given you so far, what I'm going to give you today, but also thoughts about things you feel like would really be helpful to you as a leader, that maybe the counseling department is particularly suited to help you with. The reason that I got tasked with this particular job was actually a different task. There was concern about black and white thinking, leaders that tend to see things in categories. Which isn't precisely what I've been thinking about. I've been thinking more broadly about the issue of humility and the need for it. So I put together a lot of my reflections and some thought on black and white thinking, and this is what it is. I've cobbled it together. And so truthfully, because I've been thinking about topics related to this topic for a really long time, the difficulty of this presentation is that it's putting a horse in a suitcase. There's a lot of things left that are going to be left sticking out. And my real temptation today that I have to resist is wandering off into things that interest me that aren't going to be that useful. So I'm trying to do a lot here. I'm trying to resist temptation. So the case I'm actually making today is not the case that humility good, pride bad. You've got some verses on the lead to your notes. There's really not a lot of need to make the case that God hates pride and honors humility. You're in leadership. In one fashion or another, you should know by now that we should all clothe ourselves with humility toward one another, for God is opposed to the proud but gives grace to the humble, 1 Peter 5:5. Everyone who's proud in heart is an abomination to the Lord, Proverbs 16:5, whoever humbles himself like this child is greatest in the kingdom of heaven, Matthew 18. God leads the humble in justice and teaches the humble his way. With humility comes wisdom. God gives grace to the humble, which is cited in the New Testament in a couple of different locations. I don't know. We probably don't need to make this case. But maybe what we need to do, and I'll try to explain this in a moment, I'm mainly going to try to make the case you're worse than you think. And I'm going to actually do that a lot from science and what science is showing us about the human tendencies, at least things that have helped me to be a little more humble. The truth is I'm full of pride. Last night, we were at our harvest meeting, and I was listening to Ryan talk about the reason for a harvest meeting, and he made reference to the cynical amongst us, and someone in my home group pointed at me. And I thought, what? I'm not cynical. What? And then I started thinking about things I didn't like about her. You know, pride manifests as self-justification and self-deception. And self-justification manifests as both defensiveness and counterattacking, and that was the first thing in my mind. Someone sent me a text this week telling me they appreciated a teaching that I did, and Do you know how many times I had to bite my tongue not to tell my wife about this text? Because each time I was about to tell her about this text, I thought, why are you telling her about this text? I want to get glory from my wife. I was thinking about telling you this stuff today, and I began talking myself out of it. Why? Because I don't want to admit I'm shot full of pride, right? We're all shot full of pride. It's hard to avoid. Well, the biblical words for pride typically are words that have to do with puffing up, enlarging. And the Bible teaches that we all puff ourselves up. You might think, well, the person with low self-esteem doesn't puff themselves up. It's interesting. If you try to challenge someone with low self-esteem, they'll resist you. Why? Because they are full of pride. They trust their account of themselves more than even God's. And so whether we think a lot of ourselves or we think very little of ourselves, pride typifies us. We're puffed up. And so we puff ourselves up in a variety of ways. One way is just to do what I said. We tell stories about ourselves where we're the hero. We retell stories about interactions we have where we're the hero. But we also have this great habit of mowing other people down, right? There's two ways for me to look bigger. One is to puff myself up. The other is to mow others down. And so when the psalmist talks about his heart not being pride, his eyes not being haughty, he's saying, I neither puff myself up nor mow others down. Instead, he tucks into God. Words related to humility are words that have meanings like making yourself low. The Bible concept isn't that you lower yourself beyond reality, it's that you shrink to reality. The presumption is you're already full of pride. And so, pride and humility. It's kind of a sprawl. These are sprawling ideas. In fact, Andrew Murray suggests that pride is the chief sin. C.S. Lewis said, all other sins are gnats compared to this sin. It's the mother of all other sins. You could see this really in Genesis, can't you? When Satan's temptation of Eve is what? That she should trust herself. She should trust her account of what's going on. She should mistrust God's account of what's going on. What was the temptation of Christ? The first temptation offered to him was that he was hungry and he should take care of his own needs. What's the implied ding against God in saying, take care of your own needs? God's not taking care of your needs. And then when Jesus decided, no, I'm going to trust the Father, his next response was, you don't really trust the Father, otherwise you'd throw yourself off this building. You know, you shouldn't trust him, then you don't trust him. And so this is his native language. He tries to get us to over-trust ourselves, and he tries to get us to under-trust God. And so pride is self-righteous. I've never heard an argument between two people that wasn't an argument about who was the most righteous. If someone says, when you said this, the other person will immediately start explaining why they said this. Why? They're defending their righteousness. They'll counterpunch with, yeah, but you said that. Why? They can't endure being the unrighteous one in the argument. And so we're full of self-righteousness. It's sort of an identity rooted in my own behavior. Our enemy loves to get us in the ground of our own performance because that's where he kicks our butt. And yet he has an ally in our own flesh. We love to stand on the ground of our own performance and defend ourselves. And so pride is self-righteous. It's self-deceiving. It's self-justifying. It's presumptuous. You know, how many times have you seen a behavior or heard someone say something and think you know why they did it? That's presumptuousness. That's what prideful people do. Humility, though, doesn't live from personal performance. It lives from Christ's performance. It doesn't trust its own narratives, right? We create narratives about what we're like. This is what self-justification looks like. This is what self-deception looks like, because I'm writing a story. I'm telling you a story about my righteousness. But a humble person doesn't trust that story. Not altogether. It's a humble person is agnostic about other people's motives. I have a friend who years ago said this, and it really stuck with me. He said, you don't know that when someone was speculating about motives. You can't know that. You don't know that. You can't know that. Humility is not presumptuous about what other people's motives are. Humility is able to say, you did this, you said this, help me understand what it means. It asks people why instead of assuming it knows why. Pride has an overinflated view of what it knows. Adam and Eve would be a great example of a couple who had an overinflated view of what they knew. Saul would be an example of this too. He's waiting for Samuel to show up to offer a sacrifice so he can go fight the Philistines, and Samuel doesn't show up. And people start leaving. And Saul, because he's unable to think past what's going on around him, he's unable to think toward the Lord, because of all of this, he decides, well, I'll force myself to offer a sacrifice here, and he offers a sacrifice. He knew he had to do this in order to fight against the Philistines. He was wrong. Eve was wrong. Adam was wrong. Humility has a much more tentative view of what it knows. You know, when Mordecai's talking to Esther, he says, who knows but what you were put in this position for such a time as this? He didn't say, I know you were. He said, who knows but what? Maybe this is why you're here. When David's praying for his dying child, he's praying and fasting, and people are afraid to tell him his child is dead. And he realizes in watching people's demeanors that the child is dead. And they said they were afraid to tell him the child was dead because they were afraid of what he might do. If he's this bad when the child's sick, how bad is he going to be when the child's dead? And David said, who knows? I didn't know, but what if I pled with God, he would issue mercy in this case. He didn't know, and so he prayed. Not knowing, being tentative, of course, doesn't stop you from acting. Ecclesiastes makes the same point. In the second half of Ecclesiastes, he makes the point that you can't figure things out. You know, lazy people get rich, hardworking people fail, the good die young, the wicked live on for a long time. But as he works through all these observations, the things just don't make sense. His solution is based on this truth, that what God builds lasts. And so do what's in your hands to do, because you don't know whether this will work or that. Just do what's in your hands to do. And so humility is tentative about what it knows. I don't know if I plant my seed here, if I'll get a good crop. If I plant these plants here, I'll get a better crop. I don't know. I just have to do what's in my hands to do, knowing that what God builds lasts. And so it's tentative, but it's activistic as well. Pride has a horizontal focus. Saul, I guess, would be an example of a guy with a horizontal focus in that little sacrifice story I told earlier. It's horizontally focused in that it's looking at, this is just logical. And when people say this is just logical, what they mean is they're looking horizontally. And this is how things piece together when you're looking horizontally. Watchman Nee makes the point when he's talking about prayer to say that when faced with a pile of problems, we fret more than pray, we scheme more than pray, we recruit more than pray, we plot more than pray. In short, everything's more important than prayer. This is the horizontal focus. I think part of this horizontal focus too, I'm just going to throw this in, it's not really in your notes, is that pride is very self-attentive. It's very self-focused. It's full of self-thoughts. So I'll tell you a little bit more about myself and my pride. And I've talked about this before, so I'm not going to go into great detail, but one of the things I grew up under was a sense there was something about me that was shameful. And when you hear that someone is full of shame, part of you should properly feel pity. I'm not asking for pity right now, but should properly feel pity. But another part of you needs to understand something about shame. It's incredibly narcissistic. It can't stop thinking about itself. It can't stop thinking about itself relative to other people's opinions. Isn't this a horizontal focus? Isn't this pride? Health, for me, didn't come from getting a better view of myself or becoming good in some areas where I was getting praise from people. Health, for me, came from spending more and more time thinking about the greatness of God. Waking up in the morning, having memorized and masticating and meditating on truths about God that I've memorized in Psalm 23 or Psalm 73 or Hebrews 13. In some passages in Zephaniah, and I've got another raft of passages I want to commit to memory in the future. Why? I want him to enlarge so I can shrink. I want to have my mind filled with him so it's not so filled with what I think about me or others think about me. Pride is very horizontally focused, whereas humility has a vertical focus. Think about Joseph. Joseph's my hero because he gets enslaved as a teenager. He doesn't get released from prison until he's nearly 40. And yet he comes out of this hardship very convinced that whatever intentions his brothers had, God's intentions were good. And even then, all he really understood about God's plans, this is the thing about a vertical focus, is you have to realize God plays a really long game, a game that exceeds your life. Because he didn't know a nation was going to come out of this. He didn't know this family was being reabsorbed or absorbed into Canaanite culture and would have died if God hadn't brought it into Egypt and ghettoized it in Goshen. He didn't know this. He didn't know a book was coming out of this. He didn't know a Messiah was coming out of this. He didn't know we'd still be talking about him millennia later. He knew none of this. All he knew is, my God has a good intention. Daniel and his friends would be an example of this. You know, they're not going to bow down into worship. Why? Because their God is able to protect them. And even if he chooses not to, which is his option, they're still not going to worship. Someone with a vertical focus has a remarkably different attention on something other than the person with a horizontal focus. The person with a horizontal focus is very attentive to what other people think. The person with the vertical focus is first and foremost most interested that God gets attention. And if they get attention at all, they want it to be always and only from him. So a verse that's arrested me for a long time now is Jesus talking to the religious leaders in John 5:44, where he explains to them why his miracles and his words have no effect on them. And he explains it to them this way: you cannot believe because you seek glory from one another instead of the glory from the one and only God. That desire to get glory is not a sin. Otherwise, Jesus wouldn't suggest you should seek it from God. It's actually baked into us, this desire to be significant. What Jesus has pointed out is you're trying to get it from people and not God, and that's why you don't trust me. So I was thinking about things Jesus said in the book of John. He says, the Son can do nothing of himself unless it's something he sees the Father doing. What's he doing? He's giving glory to the Father. I can do nothing on my own initiative. Glory to the Father. I don't receive glory from men. So he's receiving glory from the Father. Even in John, at some point he says, Father, glorify the Son. The very next part of the sentence is, so the Son may glorify you. I want glory only in as much as it brings attention to you. I've come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. My teaching is not mine, but his who sent me. I've not come of myself. I can do nothing on my own initiative. I've not come on my own initiative, but he sent me. I don't seek my glory. I don't speak on my own initiative. The word which you hear is not mine, but the Father who sent me. This is just all from the Gospel of John. Pride is willful and controlling. Pride wants to have its will done. The meek, what's meek? Someone who's meek is someone who is not weak. It rhymes with meek, and it's tempting to think that meek is weak, and you could write a poem about the meek, weak person. But weakness is a lack of any strength. Meekness is having strength under control of God. Just like a meeked horse is a horse whose strength is under the control of the rider, so a meek person is a person whose strength is under the control of God. And so a meek person may have lots of strengths, but they hold them in check at the Father's will. My personal journey, I'm going to go through this kind of quickly because I don't want to tap too much of our time, is that I've spent, many years ago, I started thinking about the glory of God, and I've already referred to some of this to you, and that's played a certain role. I'd studied Ecclesiastes, and I thought the two big observations in Ecclesiastes is nothing lasts or deeply satisfies the first half, and you can't figure anything out second half. And I realized that why is it that things not lasting or satisfying are so problematic for us? It's because of pride. We don't want gifts from a giver. We want things we can possess and hold on to and accrue. Right? That's pride. And in the second half, when he says we can't figure anything out, his solution is what God builds lasts. And so it's pride that has to see an outcome. Right? It's humility that trusts God with the outcome. So that has affected me. There are two secular books that have had a remarkable impact on my understanding of humility. One is Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me, written by two social psychologists, and they absolutely convinced me that I am so full of self-deception and self-justification. It happens so quickly and seamlessly that I cannot trust the conclusions I draw. And it also convinced me that my memory supports my self-deception and self-justification. You know what it's like to have a fight with someone when you realize this about yourself and they don't? You sit there and they'll say, you said, and you're thinking, okay, I really believe what these scientists are saying. And so you think, I don't think I said that. I don't know if I said that. Oh, you said it. The trouble with human interactions is that the pride in you hooks the pride in me. And so it's not enough to be humble about whether your memory is accurate or not. You have to stay humble when the pride in someone else is encouraging you to go puff yourself up like a toad. So that's been a helpful book. And lately, I've been reading generally about human intuition that most of the decisions we make are anchored in human intuition. And but I read this book called Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman, and he's a Jewish psychologist. He had a colleague, Aaron Tversky, who's since passed. And the two of them noodled on this idea of why humans make predictable mistakes in judgment. And they came up with an idea I'll talk about here in a little bit, but that's been helpful for me too, that it's made me a little less confident that what I think is discernment is actually just intuition and it may be wrong. But I've had experiences too. You know, when I first came around here, I noticed a lot of people were trying to build their own personal kingdom. And that was pride driven. And when it didn't work out, a lot of people got disgruntled and left. I've been counseling with some younger men, and I've heard this more than once where they'll say, "I want to be Xenos famous." Has anyone ever heard this before? I heard it and I'm like, "What?" And I made them repeat it several times, and I thought, oh, they want glory from Xenos people. And other experiences like my own poor listening skills, other people's poor listening skills when I'm trying to counsel people in conflict. You know, why do we listen so poorly? Honestly, I think at its heart it's pride. We can't, especially if we're in conflict, we find it almost impossible to sit still and be curious about the other person's perspective. We feel compelled to explain ourselves, to defend ourselves, to counterpunch. Pride. Motive guessing in conflicts. Wow. If I could get everyone to stop doing this, there would be so few conflicts. Black and white thinking. What do you think about black and white thinking? Is it good or is it bad? Those who laugh probably aren't black and white thinkers. Those who are trying to come up with an answer may be. Yeah, black and white thinking. Just a little bit about this. Everyone's a black and white thinker when they're young. Most people's prefrontal cortex isn't really even developed until they're about 25. And so it's normal. Black and white thinking is simple. The less experience you have, experience has a way of graying you, literally and figuratively, in how you think. This is kind of endemic to when you're young. People who are abused tend to see things in black and white categories. It could be because developmentally they get arrested. It also could be that if you're in danger, yes or no is probably the best question you need answered. Am I in danger or am I not in danger? Are they bad or are they good? Right? These questions need answered. So a lot of people that deal with abuse have to learn how to think more gray about things. You know, Bev describes this as someone sees themselves as a victim. That's a black and white category. Or they see themselves as a survivor, black and white category. And that an abuse victim just keeps switching back and forth between these two poles. You know, victim, survivor. And she tries to help people to start understanding that they don't have all power and they don't have no power. That you have some power. They can make some decisions. That's a grayer way of thinking, or what she would call a thriver category. People with mental health issues may tend toward black and white thinking. Autistic people tend toward black and white thinking. Personality disorders tend toward black and white thinking. Eating disorders tend toward black and white thinking. And so sometimes people struggle with mental health issues and they struggle along with also thinking in black and white categories. Sometimes it's just inadequate intellectual training. You can kind of see this. I don't know if you've seen, what's that guy's name that did Borat? I forget his actual name. But he has this video series now called Who is America? And he dresses up and fools people. But he forces black and white thinking on the person he's interviewing and gets them to agree to the stupidest things. Like, he convinces a senator that there's a program in Israel for training kindergartners to use weapons, and that this would be something we should do here in America to protect the schools. And they end up agreeing with him. And one of the guys says, well, what are they going to do, throw a pencil box at him? Right? And so it's like, oh my God, inadequate intellectual training. Black and white communication can come from someone because they're a black and white thinker, you know, forcing you into either you're for us or you're against us. You know, it's either this or it's that. Which is it? Right? Have you ever been around a black and white communicator? If they think in black and white categories, they see things in just polar ways. Sometimes people aren't black and white thinkers, but they manipulate people by forcing black and white categories on others. So this idea of, look, you're either for us or you're against us, so which is it? Is trying to force someone to think in a black and white way. Sometimes it's just a simple way to communicate. Black and white thinking, good or bad, the truth is that some black and white thinking is good. Wisdom literature is black and white thinking. There's the wicked and then there's the righteous. That's black and white. We know there's a lot of things in between, but sometimes it's helpful in communication to communicate in black and white ways. You know, if you look at the Proverbs, raise a child in the way he'll go, and when he's old, he won't depart from it. A black and white thinker is, that's false. A gray thinker is like, that's generally true. It's not always true. The Bible is false, is how black and white thinkers look at wisdom literature when there are exceptions to the rule. Well, I'm going to move through this part, I hope, quickly, which is that humility is critical in personal ministry. I don't feel like I really need to make the case here either, because the Bible shot through with this. But it's certainly important in body life. Ephesians 4, I implore you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling with which you've been called, with all humility and gentleness. That's also the word meekness. With patience, showing tolerance for one another, in love, being diligent to preserve the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. Walk worthy. What's that? That's humble submission to the Father. With humility, which is to have a low understanding of your own self. In meekness, dependence on and trusting God versus your personal strengths, versus your personal goals. Meekness manifests as patience and kindness and gentleness and alertness to what God is doing. With patience, showing tolerance. You know, the ability to absorb the challenges other people bring to you only happens when you don't feel like you're all that important. The rest of the passage argues for interdependence. Halsby, in his book Under His Wings, says, the meekness which we reveal in our dealings with our fellow men is a gauge which shows accurately how much we in our hearts have humbled ourselves before God. It says, we all think that it's of paramount importance to be noticed, admired, talked about, and praised. We expect people to take notice of our talents, our ability. That's why we feel more or less disappointed and ignored if people do not appreciate us. In fact, such disappointment is oftentimes so deep-seated it destroys Christian fellowship and cooperation on a large scale. And practically every Christian flock, there is a greater or lesser number of both men and women who feel they've been misunderstood, set aside by the leaders. They become peeved, pouty. They inject a great deal of bad blood into the groups with slander and intrigue. Finally, they surrender completely to the spirit of factionalism, divide the flock into two groups, thus doing irreparable damage for a long time to come. What's he saying? The root of the destruction of body life is you needing to be recognized. It's certainly true in discipling. You know, there's so much to say here, I'm not going to say hardly anything, except if you're going to disciple someone, you need to be very attentive to what God is doing in their life instead of what you want to do to them. One thing Bev ran across when she went to Larry Crabb's seminar recently was that he had people sit down in small groups and share what God had been doing in their life or things that were troubling them at the moment. And they each went around, they did the same thing. His rule was you're not allowed to offer advice or scripture. The only time you talk is to help them continue to tell their story. And this is what she noticed. She wanted to inject so much. So many times she wanted to say things. And she kept biting her tongue and biting her tongue and biting her tongue. This is the second thing she noticed. The person ended up where she was trying to guide them. Or she would have tried to direct them. But by the time they got there, they had their own conclusions. And people are much more persuaded by the ideas in their own head than the ideas in yours. You can't disciple someone if you can't wait patiently and be really curious long enough that you can watch what the Spirit's doing and support it in some way. The downside, of course, of doing this is you don't get credit. People won't say things like, "Wow, Lee, man, he just opened my eyes." They'll say things like, "God showed me." Oh, God gets the glory. Very bad when God gets the glory. We did it in leadership too. I'm not going to really go through that because I want to get to something else. The case I really am trying to build here is you're worse than you think. C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity says, "If anyone would like to acquire humility, I think, tell him the first step. The first step is to realize one is proud." So I'm trying to play C.S. Lewis's card here. Pride is embedded in our fallenness. I'm fallen, you're fallen. Pride is just built into your fallenness. We prefer the gifts that we get to the giver of the gifts. I mean, what's Romans 1 all about? That we know in our souls that God is the creator of all things, but we don't acknowledge, thank, or worship God. Instead, we love the creature more than the creator. And that whole spiral of sin just spills right out from that. We prefer the gifts to the giver. That's the point in Ecclesiastes, the first half of Ecclesiastes, is it's not enough for us to enjoy the good things that come our way. That's his advice. When good things come your way, enjoy. You have some good work you're doing, some good productive work, enjoy it. A blessing, some rest, some fun, enjoy it. Enjoy it, enjoy it, enjoy it. Don't cling on to it because it doesn't last or deeply satisfy. Treat it like a gift your giver gives you and enjoy it, not like something you can hang on to and make yourself something of. We ignore or take credit for God's blessings. This is God's prophecy in Deuteronomy 8. This prophecy in Deuteronomy 8 is you're going to get into the land. Things are going to go really well for you. Your flocks are going to increase. Your crops are going to increase. It's going to go great. It's going to go great. It's going to go great. And then you'll forget me. A little while later, he offers another possible interpretation. You will say, "My own strength provided these things." You either won't remember I gave them to you, or you'll actually take credit for it. Probably no one here has ever done this. You know, the 10 lepers, Christ heals them, one comes back and worships him. The others don't come back and worship him. This is, you know, can we say 10% of people come to God and thank him? I don't know if we can say that. But certainly a minority of people give God credit for God's blessing. Our heart is hopelessly self-deceived. And self-deceiving, self-justifying. Jeremiah 17:9 makes this case that the human heart is deceitful and desperately sick. Who can know it? The implication is you with this deceitful heart can't even know it. And science has validated this. And Proverbs 16 You know, we typically quote it this way: there's a way that seems right to a man, but the end is death. That's not actually how it reads. It says there is a right way that leads to death. Why does it say it that way? Because when we're in the middle of it, we don't even think it seems right. We think it is right. And this is where I want you to sort of look over to Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me, that handout you have. This is a secular account of human nature. This is not a Christian account of human nature. And their explanation is something they call cognitive dissonance. We call it fallenness. But their idea is this: when there's a mismatch between how we perceive ourselves and what we've just done, said, or thought, our brain will make up a story that will reconcile these two problems in our favor. You do it when you drive, right? You do something and someone honks at you, right? So they're saying there's something about you that's offensive, but you realize you're an excellent driver. And so you line these things up by telling a story and maybe sticking your hand out the window and telling the story to them. The problem is with you, your expectations are out of line and you're an ass, right? But we do this kind of thing all the time. And so I'm gonna try to quote a couple of things. Under this section, introduction, most people, when directly confronted with evidence they're wrong, do not change their point of view or course of action, but justify it even more tenaciously. That is why self-justification is more powerful and more dangerous than the explicit lie. It allows people to convince themselves that what they did was the best thing they could have done. In fact, come to think of it, it was the right thing. And they talk about cognitive dissonance. The state of tension that occurs whenever a person holds two cognitions, ideas, attitudes, beliefs, opinions, that are psychologically inconsistent, such as smoking is a dumb thing to do because it could kill me and I smoke two packs a day. So how do people resolve this? I like the taste. I'm afraid I'm going to gain weight. Right? What's this? This is a story you tell yourself to hold two things in tension that are in tension. We don't like two things to be in tension, and so we resolve them in favor of doing what we want to do or thinking what we want to think. They talk about something related to this called confirmation bias, and I see it as believing and seeing. That what we believe is true is what we see to be true. And so if I believe someone is a bad guy, then all their repertoire behavior, which some may be bad and some may be good, I tend to not notice the good and I only see the bad, and it confirms my bias that they're a bad person. But similarly, you may have someone in your home group you feel like is a really good woman or a really good guy, and you tend to just notice things that confirm your bias, that they're really a good person, and not notice or, you know, kind of damp down or not look at very carefully evidence to the contrary. We've lost significant leadership in this fellowship because people saw all along disconfirming evidence that this is a good guy and didn't do anything about it. Confirmation bias. And we all do this. We all silence that voice that says there's something wrong here if our bias is in favor of the person that the evidence is confirming. You know, it's typical as a discipler that the person we invest in, we like. That seems good. But that does produce bias. And so when our co-leaders are saying to us, well, what about this? What about this? If we're not humble, we can't hear the contrary evidence in a way that's actually going to be helpful for the person we're discipling, because we're too busy defending them. I sort of gave you this little taster from this book because I keep trying to get people to read it. It's a very helpful book. I think the point that they make, too, that's super important, and they spend a lot of time with this, is that your memory supports your bias. I've seen this in really extreme examples when people are in conflict, where they say, we were in the backyard, and you said, wait a minute, we were in the backyard, we were in the living room. No, we weren't, we were in the backyard. And then you said this, I didn't say that, I never would say that. Well, you did say that. And the other person's like, well, but you said this, and I did not say that. And so you're sitting there as a counselor going, these people must have been fighting with someone else. But it happens that when you're under stress, you only notice things, this is part of confirmation bias too, you only notice the things that happened in that argument that support the conclusion you drew, and you don't notice other things. And so you end up with two different stories of the same fight. And your memory is a servant to your pride. A point that they make in this book is that there's a memory expert who for years would tell this story about his academic development, where when he finished college, he wanted to go to Stanford University to pursue his career in neurobiology, but his mom wanted him to stay closer to home and go to U of M. But he fought through, he resisted his mom's influence, he ended up at Stanford where he got his degree, and then one day he got a box of correspondence from his mom. Correspondence is something we used to do on paper, and we put it in an envelope and a stamp on it and send it out. And this correspondence told exactly the opposite story. Mom wanted him to go to Stanford. He wanted to stay closer to home. He was stunned. How could he, a memory expert, not even have a correct memory of himself? Because the memory of wanting to go to Stanford put him in a more heroic light. Yikes. I don't mean that memory can't be trusted at all. I mean more like we have to be able to step back and realize my memory serves my ego, my pride, and I need to be careful about whether my memory is accurate or not. But of course, if you're in conflict, that other person is going to stimulate you to become more confident in your memory than you really should be. Because they're going to be very confident this is what happened. And you're going to be like, ooh, I really want to be confident too. You don't even think that. You just automatically start being more confident. All right. I think two, and this gets into the Kahneman material, our fallen brains don't work that well and we're blind to it. So the book... Thinking Fast and Slow. This is a little harder to read. I've tried to give you kind of a synopsis of this book, but I'll tell you briefly what it consists of. What Kahneman and Tversky discovered in their studies was that human beings have two systems in their brain that operate. The one system they call System 1. It's fast, it's intuitive, it's on all the time. It makes quick decisions because it uses certain rules of thumb that may be true but aren't necessarily true, but it uses these rules of thumb. System 2 is the math part of you, the logical part of you, the part of you that will sit there and grind on something until it really finds a good solution. But this system is lazy. And so most of the time, System 2 just takes the conclusions of System 1 and says, okay. System 2 requires a lot of energy, literally a lot of glucose in your blood. They can watch glucose levels drop as this system gets kicked on. It's exhausting to use this system, so we don't like to use it that much. And so the thinking fast and slow is the recommendation that the intuitive system has a lot of value. He tells a story about a fireman and his crew who are in a kitchen putting out a kitchen fire, and the captain suddenly ordered, he didn't even know why he did it. He ordered everyone out of the room, and as soon as they got out of the room, the floor collapsed. The fire was in the basement. Later, he's trying to put it together, and he's like, okay, the fire was unusually quiet, and my ears were hot. Those were the only clues he had, and it saved their life. It's not like an intuitive system is bad. You know, that sense you're being prowled upon, someone's following you. So these rules of thumb can be quite useful, but they can also be prone to error. So the title implies we need to think fast, but we also need to think slow. And we need to understand the biases of each system. So he'll give tests to statisticians that a statistician should be able to solve correctly, but they don't solve it correctly because they're like the rest of us and they're intuitive. If you give someone a really good story, like there was a woman who was in college, was a militant feminist, and you ask people to choose what career she has now, they'll and all of them are bank tellers, but one of the bank tellers is a militant feminist, they'll choose that one, even though predictably, you know, in terms of statistical tests, it's not necessarily true. We like the story more than the statistics. You know, there's a description given of someone who's kind of nerdy and precise and likes to organize things, and you ask the question, are they a librarian or a farmer? Well, they're, you know, obviously they're a librarian because they like to organize things and that sort of thing. There are many, many more farmers than librarians. The odds are that this person is a farmer. So, but a statistician can be persuaded by a good story too. And so I've sort of listed some of these things. I don't want to go through each one of them. If I were to say to this half of the group, did Gandhi die when he was 135 years old? And I say to this half of the group, did Gandhi die when he was 45? And then I ask you to guess how old Gandhi was when he died. You guys would overestimate and you would underestimate. Why? Because I anchored your thinking in something that was irrelevant. And we always get our thinking anchored in irrelevant data. And so we tend to overestimate or underestimate things. And so I don't know what to say. I think it would be really important to start thinking about these kinds of things. Black and white thinking, of course, is part of our fallen brain. It could be developmental, it could be abuse, it could be mental health issues, but part of what we need to learn to do is to start thinking more grayish, our developmental tendencies. You know, if I'm talking to a couple and she was raised in a situation where she felt like she wasn't loved and he was raised in a situation where he felt like he was insignificant, all of their fights are about this because she has poop-colored glasses on and she sees all of his behavior or failure to act in certain ways as evidence he doesn't love her. And he's got brown glasses on too, and he sees that all of her behavior is disrespectful. Why? Not because they're necessarily being disrespectful or unloving, but because developmentally they've developed a core intuition that they now are living out of. And most of the conflicts in really reactive couples are tied to these early stages of life where you've got gut intuitions about yourself and other people that are false. Of course, there's this problem. We want our will to be done. We have an enemy that fire hoses us with lies. The term fire hosing is being used right now to describe new propaganda techniques that the Russians and even some Americans are using. Fire hosing is the tendency to flood someone with so much falsehood from so many different directions that they get so fatigued they stop thinking about what they're hearing. And when they stop thinking about what they're hearing, they absorb it as if it's true. The RAND Corporation has a short article on fire hosing and Russia propaganda. Our enemy knows this all too well. He fire hoses us with falsehood all the time. And because our system, too, it doesn't like to put out that kind of energy, and there's so many things to react to, it just shuts down, and we just start absorbing these lies as if they're true. All the temptations to act apart from God or apart from wise counsel. all the accusations we hear or entertain against God, ourselves, and others. All the stories that we've heard that we don't check on and we pass on. In short, gossip. You know, gossip is confessing someone else's sins. And we do that a lot here in Xenos. How many times have you been in a situation where you're about to tell someone a story about someone else and you say to yourself, hopefully, why do I want to tell them this story? And most of the time, it's not because they can be helpful. It's not because we think they've got the gift of faith and they're really going to pray this through. It's either because we have the pride of wanting to be in the know. We have what the Germans call Schadenfreude, where we get a certain peculiar joy out of the failings of someone else. Pride, pride. All right. I guess this is where we're going to land. How do you pursue humility? Hopefully, I've convinced you of Lewis's point. The first best way to help you toward humility is to convince you you're proud. Hopefully, you see that. The Spirit's really the one that's got to do it, but I hope he's been poking you in the heart as we've been going along. In the book Humble Roots, Hannah Anderson says, when Jesus calls us to learn of his own humility, he intends to strip us of the pride that keeps us from experiencing rest. Come to me, all you are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Learn from me, for I am meek and humble of heart, and you'll have rest for your souls. There is a kind of tension we have as leaders. There's a kind of anxiety and burden that we have that has nothing to do with the work. It has to do with the work underneath the work, which is the work of pride. We'll be seen as a failure. We'll be seen as someone who gave bad advice. We'll be seen as someone who missed a cue that they shouldn't have missed. We can't confess our faults. Jesus seems to be suggesting this is exhausting. And becoming like him and being humble of heart allows you to escape the biggest load of weariness that we have, is that we don't measure up. All right. So almost all of this material is from Gary DeLashman, who's been accumulating humility quotes and how to keep humble for many years. I did tweak it a little bit. I did organize it a little bit. I added a few things, but it's substantially his. And this is even his category, having a substantial secret life with God. He points out that most spiritual activity is in public, and this is private. And so this is the iceberg principle, that if you have a substantial secret life with God, if you're iceberging your relationship with God, it'll have a significant effect on your humility. So being saturated in and preferring God's revelation. I don't know if I've got this here or not. Nope, I don't. Being saturated in and preferring God's revelation versus listening to my own thoughts and my own wisdom. And so part of having a substantial secret life with God is that I'm meditating on Scripture a lot. Psalm 1, who's the one that escapes being the mocker, the scoffer, the wicked person? Who escapes it? Who? The one who meditates on God's revelation night and day. Meditation is not like reading. Reading is great, but reading is water flowing through a pipe. Meditation is not transferring of information, it's formative work. It's God putting you in the fire until you're soft enough that he can shape you into what he wants. And that takes meditation. That takes waking up every morning with, you know, Gary wakes up every morning with, this is the day the Lord has made. Let's rejoice and be glad in it. And every morning that comes to his mind, every morning he ponders it. This is the day the Lord has made. takes his mind off of the past and the future. This is the day the Lord has made, puts his mind on the fact that God is full of sovereign love. Rejoice and be glad in it is that instead of complaining and moaning and all of those things that which are not helpful to our soul, the most helpful thing in the Bible, as far as I can tell, for your soul is to be grateful. So he wakes up in the morning, he ponders that every morning. I wake up and I go through Psalm 23, or I look at Hebrews 13, 5, and 6. A lot of times when I'm feeling like I'm worried about what I think of me or other people think of me, I think he himself has said, I'll never leave you. I'll never forsake you. So we say with confidence, if God is for me, who could be against me? Who is? And then I'll usually fill in the blank with whoever I'm concerned about, that I should be afraid of them. This is part of having a substantial secret life with God. If I don't meditate on Psalm 23 nearly every morning when I get up, I'll meditate on all my past failures. What's that? That's me walking on the ground of my own performance where Satan kicks my butt. I have to get my mind off of me and my performance and onto him and his. And I do that by meditating. Being grateful, I've already said this, but glorifying God is antagonistic to self-glory or obsessing about yourself or obsessing about your world. Thanking God consistently versus taking credit for things versus complaining. Praising God for who he is. Thanking God for what he's done. And so when you look at that great passage in Ephesians 5, when it starts out with don't be drunk with wine, but be filled with the Spirit, he's got four adverbial clauses after that to explain how to be filled with the Spirit. What are these four adverbial clauses? Speaking to one another in psalms and songs and spiritual sayings. What's that? Giving glory to God. Singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord. What's that? Glorifying God. Always giving thanks in all things in the name of Christ. Glorifying God. Submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. Love tied to glory to God. How do you get filled with the Spirit? Glorify God. How can you be filled with the Spirit? You could say, God, fill me with your Spirit. You know, but if you're complaining and thinking about yourself and your own performance, you're fire hosing his ability to fill you with the Spirit. He could just fill you with the Spirit. But you could cooperate by being grateful. And Gary likes this one, cultivating childlike wonder and awe for nature. So he'll go for walks, and he literally will hug trees. He can name lots of species. He's, oh, and I come to his house. He's like, come outside. Let me show you my zinnias. I'm like, oh, they're very nice. He loves nature. He loves talking about it. He enjoys it. And the thing he notices about it is how small he gets when he does it. How grateful he becomes for God as creator when he does it. I'm doing my best to try to channel him because I'm not sure I do this as much. Except I do it over stars. I do love sitting in a dark spot and looking up at the stars in the night and rejoicing over my creator. Growing in trust and submission to God's sovereignty is part of having a substantial life with God. The thing that has saved my soul through the years when I've had disappointments and setbacks and humiliating experiences is that I really do believe in the sovereign goodness of God, and that even things I hate are not out of his control and they're not unloving. Boy, if you can get that baked into your soul, then life will look different for you. So you're living in God's story versus living in your own story. I am part of God's story. He's not part of mine. Well, he is part of mine, but I'm primarily part of his. Living in the present before God versus focusing on the past or the future. Being an on-call servant versus an at-will servant. An on-call servant is someone who, when a situation comes up, they respond to it gratefully instead of waiting until they feel like it. I think probably John Cleary is the penultimate example of this in my mind. Seems like he's like, sure. I'm much more, I tend to think when I get asked, would you, I think, okay, what are the implications? And, you know, being pessimists tend to try and think through implications. And so I'm like, well, what's on my schedule currently? And blah, blah, blah. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, but there's something great about just jumping in and saying, sure. It's encouraging to the person who asks for help, too. Boasting in the Lord versus boasting in myself. We're actually not too bad at doing this for pretend. Yeah, the Lord was really good to me, and then you start going into everything you said and the wisdom you had and the impact it had. Praise the Lord. Fulfilling God's ministry call for me versus comparing myself to others. I think a lot of the stress I've seen in my tenure here at Xenos are people who compare themselves to other people, don't feel like they compare well, and then they feel morose. I'm not this like this person. I'm not this like this other person. I'm not interesting like this person. I'm not a leader like that person. I'm not a teacher like the other person. I'm not a good counselor like the other person. All I've got is this ability to, you know, help people with things, like big deal. You know, I feel mercy toward people when they're suffering, like, you know, what's that? You know, part of growing in a substantial secret life with God is having joy in how He built you and how He's using you. You know, when people describe, this is Xenos, it's all about replication and bringing people to Christ and raising them up in the Lord and growing churches and planting churches. That's a great vision. Two-thirds of that happens by people who aren't doing this evangelism and the discipling. They're doing everything else. And if you feel like, well, because I'm not on the cutting edge, I'm no good, you're comparing yourself to other people. You're not sitting with God and being happy for how He put you together, how He's using you. Lamenting and suffering well is part of having a substantial secret life with God. Lamenting is coming to God and complaining with confidence in the one you're complaining to that He's good and sovereign. So you have to not just complain, but complain well. Complain to someone who's complaining to a good, sovereign Lord. Versus stoicism, versus self-pity, versus collapsing because life didn't turn out the way you'd hoped. I think, too, isn't this interesting? The two great commands are contained in this pattern of how you pursue humility, loving God and loving others. Intriguing. God is an interesting, complex being who can teach us very simple, life-changing things. You know, the problem with pride, of course, is it's obsessed with self. With humility, it's very concerned for others and it tends to prioritize others. You know, in a home group, someone who is humble has much more of an us view of the home church than a me view of the home church. You know, they tend to use words that I find in marriage. Here's a little short aside. I hope it's not too long. I think women are made in the image of God in one way that's often distinct from men, in that they early on take an identity that's conferred by the relationship, and they use things like us and our much earlier in the relationship than men do. But it's this ability to take identity from the relationship That's what we need to do in home churches. This is part of the image of God, is that he speaks in terms of us and we. And if we're going to be like him, we need to think of our home church in terms of us and we. Why can't we all be really happy that so-and-so came to Christ or so-and-so made a major decision without having to be the one that was involved in either one? Involved in prayer, involved in concern, maybe involved in hospitality, maybe involved in having a light and enjoyable conversation with them, maybe involved in showing mercy toward them, but not directly involved. Why can't we rejoice all together and not see this as an opportunity to hate ourselves and feel like we're not good enough? Prioritizing others, having an us versus a me outlook. Delighting in people. Delighting in people. I told Gary this, so I feel like I can say it. When I first met him, I found him to be cranky and rude many years ago. I didn't know him personally. He had a gruff come off, but something has happened. I don't know what's exactly come about, but if you encounter him, he will stop and look at you and smile, and he will remember things that he knows about you or things he heard you say the last time. And he often says, people are delightful. Getting to know people is delightful. There's something God's done in his life that's got a huge effect. You need to be someone like that, who delights in people, who likes to get to know people, who likes to ponder what's good about them instead of what's not, who doesn't get bored. Doesn't get bored with people, viewing them in terms of their utility, judging their faults. I think part of prioritizing others too is we absorb their weaknesses. That doesn't mean we don't talk to people about their weaknesses. It's like everyone we encounter is going to have weaknesses, and we have to absorb them. Maybe at some point we need to say something, but most of the time we just have to absorb their weaknesses and frankly spend a lot more time delighting in them. And then if we do have to tell them something, at least they're hearing it from a fan. Being very curious about the perspectives of others, particularly when they oppose us. Hard to do. The part of pride is that if someone opposes me, I have to somehow make them align with me. But humility is actually really curious about opposing points of view, because they realize, if they haven't studied Kahneman and Tversky, they at least realize, I only have a very small slice of insight into what might be going on here. I want to hear other points of view. When someone's got criticisms toward you, I'm going to out an argument we had, or I hope you're okay with this. So a while back, I came home, I felt tired, my wife and I talked briefly, I said, look, I'm going to go read, I'm worn out. And she's like, fine. I'm like, okay, something's wrong. You know, I don't have great discernment, but I had some discernment. And I was immediately, of course, trying to justify myself in my own mind and defend myself. Look, I put in this many hours, and then after that I did another set of hours, and I talk for 10 or 15 minutes, and I have to get up early tomorrow, and can I just have a little rest, right? This is a self-defense, self-justification that all of us do. And she said something to me that suggested she wondered if I cared about her. And then, of course, now that hooks my pride. Now I'm angry because I want to counterpunch and say, yeah, well, do you care about me? Because of, you know, do you care about my, you know, why? Isn't this how arguments go? It took me actually more than a few seconds to come to any insight here at all. In fact, it took me until the next day where I thought, I need to understand where this is coming from. I need to be able to be accused and move toward my accuser with actual curiosity. I think she concluded that she was entertaining an accusation from Satan. And I had, from my own heart, she didn't say this, but I ended up thinking, there have been several instances where I begged off of conversation because I was worn out. So I can see where this would add up. And she's got stresses in her life that I haven't attended to, and I know it's helpful to talk. I mean, there's a lot of things you could say about it, but you can't get there if you're not willing to be curious when someone's not your fan. To be genuinely wanting to know. A humble person genuinely wants to understand where things are coming from. They genuinely want to understand how they've contributed. They genuinely want to know what the log is. And so while probably nobody here is going to have that immediate response, they need to be able to fight to that eventual response. If you want to create a home church full of passive and angry people, don't listen to them. Pretend like you're listening to them, but don't let it affect the decisions you've made. I went to some school board meeting years ago, and I realized about halfway through, they had already made up their mind. And nothing that was going on here was going to help things. They were trying to give the impression that we were influential without actually letting us be influential. I never went back to another meeting. All right, that's how you get someone to not participate, is that you don't actually invite them to give you any input. Taking the lower seat versus prior pushing and politicking and scheming. Helping others succeed versus wanting my own success. I'm going to tell you one of my most embarrassing secrets. I could be sitting listening to a teacher, at a servant team meeting, listening to a teacher, and always there'll be some thought at some point, I wonder if they're going to mention my name. I feel so embarrassed to tell you this. But that's pride, right? It doesn't go away. It's with you all the time. The best you can do is to see it and call it for what it is, and then ask God to help you rejoice that His name is being elevated. Pursuing and keeping a realistic view of yourself. I really would like you to read Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me, because I want you to be more realistic about yourself. I want you to be less confident that your memory is a recording of what happened. The part of your brain, memories aren't stored in a spot. They're stored all over the place. The olfactory cues are stored in one place, the visual cues in another, the auditory cues in another. They're stored in various places. The physical reaction you had stored in another place. And there's a part of the brain that pulls these things back together and stitches them into a narrative. It's the same part of your story that's linked to imagination. And this is the part of your brain that makes up stories where you're the hero and someone else is the villain. I want you to stop having so much confidence your memories are actually a record of reality. Memory is very valuable. You just have to sort of be careful that you don't trust it altogether, that you let other people's memories help shape it into something that maybe is closer to reality. So I want you to read that book. I want you to have a realistic view of yourself. And so keep learning what the Bible has to say or godly people have to say about this. Andrew Murray's Humility, Humble Roots is good. What's the Fortnow book, which is the Prideful Soul's Guide to Humility. Spiritual books, the Bible itself. Gary's probably got 16 pages of quotes on humility in a file. He gave them to me, and I thought, I don't have time to read these, much less use them. But it's good. Keep pursuing this. Be tentative about what you know. get used to saying and meaning, I think this is true, but I'm not sure. I don't think that happened. This is what I think happened, but I can't be altogether confident. And please don't get hooked when someone else is confident into being more confident yourself. Stay humble even if you're with people who are not. Confessing sin. I like this one quote. I don't confess my sin because I'm humble. I do it because it helps me be humble. The only reason I'm telling you about my humiliating and embarrassing mental tendencies is not because I'm humble, it's because I want to be humble. And when people confess their sin, it opens up the entire community to start confessing sin. Every major revival in history has begun with people confessing sin publicly. The Korean explosion happened when a pastor spoke to his congregation and admitted that he had embezzled money from his best friend's widow. And then someone else stood up and confessed to some sin, and someone else stood up and confessed to a sin, and the shame culture that would never do such a thing began doing such a thing, and a revival happened in Korea. The Wesleyan movement began with people meeting together in these little cells, and one of the chief elements in this interaction was to confess sin. That went away shortly after the movement, and the movement began to be less and less vital. Confessing sin. I wonder if it's tied to humbling ourselves and so that God can be large on our behalf. Admitting non-moral weaknesses to others depending on their strengths. Like, not every weakness is a moral weakness. I'm just not really good at that. Could you give me insight into how to see this? What's your view of this? You know, I got a lot of friends who are really strong in helps ministry. They have saved my bacon so many times. Because I don't know how to even get into practical projects. So I'm at my new home and I'm looking at this electric stove, this built-in stove, and I'm like, I don't know how to remove this thing. I can't look behind it because it's built in, and I'm looking in the oven, I can't figure it out. I'm scratching my head, I'm scratching my bum. You know, I say, Nick, do you know how to remove an electric stove that's built in? Boom, the door's out in the patio. Boom, the thing's on the patio. In less than 2 minutes, he had the whole thing torn out. I was really embarrassed. But isn't humility learning to depend on, count on, rejoice in the many gifts that are in your church? Being weak. Being very curious about the criticisms of others, making it easy for them to express criticism. If you can do this, you're well on your way toward an actual humble life. Keep repenting of your self-glory project before other people. All right. That's all I have. I've got some material that I would suggest for reading. This is a very short list. Thinking Fast and Slow, if you have the chops and the stamina to read it, is worth it, but it's going to take more work. Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me, much more accessible, and probably a good place to start if you're not used to reading in this area. And several others. I like Keller's little teaching on blessed self-forgetfulness from 1 Corinthians 4, because he sort of points out how pursuing glory from God provides radical freedom to serve others. And a few other things. All right, so it's 11:33. And I did nothing but talk. I was advised that I should have exercises so people can really understand this and plow it into their souls. I just, frankly, am not very good at that kind of thing. So I'm very interested in fielding questions. I think Nick Hetrick is also going to field questions. You can direct them at him or me or...
You mentioned absorbing people's weaknesses. I don't know what that means.
Absorbing
people's weaknesses versus reacting.
So... You know, I've got friends who are kind of high maintenance. They complain a lot. They want a lot. They're really good at certain things. They tend to notice people's problems. And I know one guy in particular in my group who is almost the only person who calls me and says, "Did you notice?" And someone in the group that we at a meeting we had the night before, and is burdened about them. And which is a great quality. Also has a lot of strengths in the area of help. So he's pastoral and helps oriented. And yet there's all these other things about him that are frankly a big pain. So absorbing their shortcomings means that I spend more time thinking about, I love his pastoral heart. And I love how he's just can do when it comes to helping people in practical ways. I spend less time thinking about, he's complaining, he's had this marital problem forever that he doesn't seem to be able to make progress with. You know, it's not like these other things don't get attention and, you know, supportive attention at times, but a lot of these things are really chronic. He's probably going to be, in some of these ways, he's going to be this way until he's dead. To absorb those weaknesses means that's not where I'm spending most of my time. And in as much as it inconveniences me, I'm able to say, this is what it's like to serve the Lord. Is he had to absorb the inconveniences of the people he was around, right? Like, I spent 3 years working with you jokers and you're still arguing about who's the greatest. That's a lot to absorb on your way to your death. That kind of thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Thanks for asking. Nick, if you don't get up here, they're all going to ask me questions. May?
I have a really hard time understanding how to be humble but still be like lovingly bringing that up. That, like, I try to, you know, I just am always in that tension. Like,
yeah. So if I'm repeating your perspective. Sometimes you're talking with someone about a problem and the first thing they do is counterpunch. They start talking to you about all your problems. And how do you handle that? How do you stay on task with the thing you're concerned about without being, resisting critique that's coming your way? You got to solve that?
Well, I mean, one strategy is to say, I'm happy to talk about any number of my problems. Right now, can we talk about this thing? I mean, that's oversimplifying, but that's one strategy. Mm-hmm. So that then you're not communicating, well, I don't want to hear that, and we're talking about your, you know, you're basically showing the curiosity, but delaying the conversation. That's one way.
Yeah. I think, too, not being surprised when it happens, because part of being a self-justifying and self-deceived person, which everybody in the room is that you shouldn't be shocked when someone comes back with a counterpunch, or they come back with a justification, or they come back with, to them it doesn't feel like justification, it feels like an explanation. If you understood, which I'm trying to explain to you, you wouldn't feel the way you feel, right? So no one here should be shocked if that happens. You should see it for what it is. It's part of our fallenness. And I think the delay the conversation, not push away from the critique is good. And not being shocked, I think, is important. I think, too, if you get embroiled in defending yourself, you're both now on the ground of your own performance. And Satan will kick both of your butts.
I guess another thing would be that you have to actually go back and ask. I mean, you can't make that suggestion idly, and you have to go back and demonstrate. I mean, I think that's a powerful demonstration of humility. If you go back and say, now, it sounded like maybe you had some feedback to give me. I'm ready to hear that.
Oh, cool. Thanks.
So, when it comes to trusting our memories, like if you are in a situation where you're talking about an issue and you disagree on like the past, how do you go about that? Because like if you don't have an agreement on what actually happened or like the exact things that were said, how are you supposed to move forward in addressing some type of issue?
I think you have to stay tentative about your memories. Hopefully you're with someone who is willing to be tentative about their own because they've come to realize this too. I find that what happens a lot of times is that the Spirit will show me, especially when I'm tentative about my memories, the Spirit will show me that some of the things they said they remembered were actually true. Or even if what they think I said wasn't true, my intentions actually were what they were thinking they were, right? And so then I get to come back and talk about that. My one of the watershed experiences I've had in my life was being criticized by my wife repeatedly for dominating at leaders' meetings. And I did what every self-righteous person does. I began explaining, that is justifying, why I didn't intend that, which I didn't intend to hurt anybody's feelings, that I do get excited about ideas, which I was getting excited about ideas. This happened so much that whenever I drove away from a leaders' meeting, I felt sick to my stomach because I knew what was coming. And there was a point at which I went into my song and dance again. I get excited about ideas. I didn't intend to hurt anyone's feelings. And she said, it doesn't matter what you intended, it matters what you did. And I was like silenced. And about 24, 40 hours later, the Spirit revealed to me that there was another piece to this story I didn't know, which was I had a low view of my co-leaders. And so... Okay. So, you have any other thoughts on that idea?
Just on that, I think there's a good section, just since you're looking for more stuff to read, there's a good section in Difficult Conversations on Intent versus Impact that I think gets at, it doesn't get at the part that of what's under the surface, but it gets at the part where it's like, okay, you know, we can debate the details about what you said, but like the point is, here's what happened. I also think that, you know, going back and forth about the details of what happened usually isn't really, I think people bog down in that really fast. And I think you have to think and pray through, like, what exactly is the thing that I'm trying to talk about here? And how important is it that we nail down every single detail about what happened? And I think if you're coming in to bring some sort of critique or something, if you've been thoughtful about what you're trying to bring up, then the incidentals of what happened in a particular occasion are probably not the make or break, you know?
That's a good point. So. Kathy, you've had your hand up for a while.
You know, like you say, confessing our sin. So what would be the best way to try to navigate through that?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
I think sometimes confessing sin, I've seen this like with guys dealing with porn, where they'll get a little porn support group together, meaning they'll confess every week that they've sinned, but nothing happens. And so they're really just supporting each other in their sin. And so I think sometimes confessing sin isn't really productive. I think sometimes if you're just confessing your sin and are morose because you're a sinner, then you haven't really gone to the cross, because the cross tells us that we're forgiven and we should come out the other end rejoicing, not that we're righteous, but that Jesus, the righteous one, took on our sin. So I think if someone's confessing sin and they're not getting to joy, then probably they're not fully confessing their sin. Some people hate hearing the confession of sin because they don't do it because they can't tolerate the discomfort they feel to admit fault. I've known a few people in my life who I've never heard them admit sin in general, or in particular, just sin in general. They'll say, yes, I'm a sinner. Did you sin here? No. Let me explain why what I did was right, why what I did wasn't wrong, why you're not remembering things accurately, why, by the way, your motives were all screwed up. I feel bad for the few people I know in this boat because I haven't really seen them substantially change. In fact, Peck, in his book, The People of the Lie, makes the point, because he's trying to answer the question as a secular psychiatrist, is there any such thing as an evil person? And his answer to the question is, yes, there is such a thing as an evil person, and he describes them as a malignant narcissist who can endure any pain except the pain of self-critique. And so sometimes people hate this because they're dangerously close to being evil.
There's a mic over here already.
I wondered, I guess this is more for Lee, because Nick, I don't know if you've read the Thinking Fast and Slow book, but for us in Christian community, how do you get to the point where, A, you can trust the system, one, to be spiritually based, you know, because it is an intuitive, quick thinking, quick responding system. How do you get to the point where that is trustworthy, and also how do you get to the point where system two is not bogging down system one by trying to reanalyze everything in light of, you know,
system two doesn't bog down anything because it doesn't like to work. But I don't think learning to trust your intuition is the goal. I think learning to be tentative about your intuition because you understand its limitations is the goal. You know, I think, and if you read through Thinking Fast and Slow, at the end of each chapter, Kahneman has situations, just one sentence situations, where we might be tempted to think this because, and then he'll mention the points that he was making in the book. We might be inclined to think this is not the way it is because, and so what he ends up with is something like being more, because you understand how it works, you're not so certain about its conclusions. And then those tentative conclusions you draw, then you run system two to explore.
I had a thought real quick, actually.
Okay.
I want to get people.
He wants to finish up.
Yeah, I got a thought here real quick. I was just thinking about the idea of leading people into humility. Now, obviously, we have to have humility to guide somebody toward it, but I was thinking about one thing I noticed about a lot of what you were saying is that there are a lot of indirect routes here. You know, all of these practical suggestions, these were not making a call on people to be more humble. You know, it's very hard for me to think of a situation in which you go to someone and say, I think you need to be more humble. And they're like, you know, you're right. And then they start to, you know. So I think kind of taking the side door here by cultivating this private life with God and prioritizing other people, I think that's worth raising to consciousness for leaders. You don't get people to grow in humility by telling them they need to be more humble, right? But I also think that one maybe good way in would be conflict. Since one of the first principles of conflict resolution is take out the log, I think that is a potentially really powerful point of departure for getting somebody into considering the need for humility. But a related question would be, I was curious if you think that there's an occasion where you would directly call on someone and say, the problem here is just your lack of humility. You know, when would you name an issue that way with a co-leader or a disciple or a friend or something?
I might be more tempted to talk about what I'm seeing and let the Holy Spirit help them draw conclusions about humility. It seems to me like you're having a lot of trouble just sitting still and hearing what someone else is saying. It seems like as soon as someone offers a suggestion, you offer a counter, and it doesn't seem like you're trying to consider what they're saying.
Yeah.
Right? And what do you think that is? Why do you think you're doing this?
Yeah, that's good.
We say we believe in multiple leadership, but you're not acting like you believe that's true.
Yeah, that's good.
So I think one real powerful way to engage people is just to notice out loud what you see, not your guesses about their motives. A lot of times we say, I'm just telling you what I see, but what we're describing is what we think their motives are, what their intentions are. But saying what you said this, you did this, it has this impact, notice, impact, ask. And I think the Holy Spirit can do something with that.
I feel a real tension a lot of times between having this humble perspective of I don't know everything, I don't know what the best course is for this person's spiritual life and like how they need to grow and what God's doing in their life, and I don't know their motives, versus being able to set direction, especially in discipleship. So I feel like I either have to take one or the other. Either I'm humble and I don't know everything, or I know what's going on with them and I really push in their life to like make things happen, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering if you have any insight on like how to resolve that, how to be able to like set direction for someone, but also stay with this humble perspective that I don't know everything.
I've got a couple of thoughts, but what do you think, Nick?
So you're describing a tension between I don't want to be overconfident about the direction I think this person needs to go on the one hand, but on the other hand, as a disciple or a leader, I'm supposed to be setting the course, basically.
Yeah, especially when it's like, you know, a lot of times people don't know the sin in their life, and, you know, I just feel like a lot of times people don't recognize those issues, and so... You said it better than I'm saying it.
That's fine. Yeah, I'll just one thought, and then I'll at least say whatever you want to say. I think that too many disciplers too often are setting their course for discipleship by reacting to people's problems. And so I think that the majority of discipleship is that we're trying to see Christ formed in people, and that's a proactive project. And so you think about all the areas in which people need to grow and become sanctified and capable and build a ministry and build relationships. And I could pick from a list of 50 different things that every single Christian believer needs to grow in, and it's going to be right because it's biblical. And so I don't think most of our course setting in discipleship should be a matter of seeing which problem to solve next. I think it should be seeing how we're going to cultivate mature believers, and sometimes that involves reacting to things, and that's where the humility maybe is more germane to the issue. So
oh, that's good. I like that.
Yeah. The mindset of seeing your group as like a we or us perspective, you talked about that, and I thought that was interesting. How do you kind of maybe adopt that, or maybe help other people adopt that kind of thinking? Do you have any thoughts along those lines?
I think a great period I've had in my life that I haven't really repeated successfully, but I would like to, is something happened. Our group was small. We were involved in a lot of ministries outside of our group, and we weren't succeeding at evangelism in the group. The group wasn't growing in that sense, but there was a lot of vital ministry happening outside of the group that we're all very excited about. During that time, we stopped teaching for a period of time in our home churches so we could pray for all this external ministry that was beginning. That actually helped create a corporate sense of things, a corporate sense that was more directed toward God. Another thing that was happening during that same time is people just began noticing out loud, whether we're sitting around a campfire or in a home group setting, whatever it was, we just started to notice people's gifts and expressing appreciation for those gifts. And it became very common. And so if a lot of people are starting to really appreciate and enjoy other people's gifting, then no one is the star. So I think if we take an Ephesian approach to our group, then we should sort of admire and appreciate and extol what God has done through different people. And I think as we're doing that, then there aren't really stars. It's just a well-functioning body. It's probably not super thought out, but...
I agree with that, and I think that starts between us or the other people and the Lord. I think I've been asking people lately, probably through noticing the absence of it in my own life, like, how much time do you spend, how regularly do you find yourself thanking God for the people in our group and not for the thing that they did? Like, how often do you just bring those people before God and say, man, I'm glad that this person is this way? And I ask that question to people, and then I have to be like, because I, like, don't do that, you know? But I bet that would help. I can imagine it would help me if I were to do it as much as I ask people about it.
Thanks.
All right.
So you were talking about black and white thinking and how part of that is developmental. And you mentioned that before the age of 25, the prefrontal cortex isn't fully developed. And in the college group, like, that's everyone I'm working with. And so I was just wondering if you had any advice or resources mm-hmm. on how to help people develop, beyond just mm-hmm. black and white thinking at that stage.
If you Google dichotomous thinking or black and white thinking, you'll find some resources for teachers with children. And you can actually teach children to think in a more nuanced way, even though their brain's not fully developed. And I think you can set up situations in your communities where you're saying, what do you think about this? And let the black and white thinking sort of come up. And then say, well, what about this fact? How does that help you? And they're either going to ignore the fact or they're going to incorporate it and realize things are starting to get gray. One thing that was really helpful for me, because I kind of grew up in a blue-collar family and was the only one that went to college or graduate school, was that I kind of went into it not very intellectually trained. And an old professor said to me one time, if you have problems with ambiguity, grow up. That actually was very helpful for me, because I realized that I didn't have much tolerance for ambiguity. And part of teaching people not to be dichotomous in their thinking is teaching them to gain more tolerance for not having an answer by the end of the conversation.
Is the balance between creativity, thinking, and then, you know, as you get older, you get more gray in your thinking, with wisdom comes with age, but the balance there is the people under 25 have this creativity mm-hmm. that they offer. It's almost a gray area.
And you think the creativity comes from black and white thinking?
No, I'm saying it's not. It's there.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
Things to value in different communities. Okay.
Can I go? You're looking at me.
Hmm?
Okay. Could you speak to the difference between noticing someone's behavior and actions, for example, someone's doing things that are seeming pretty controlling, their behavior seems controlling, over-controlling, and letting them, pointing that out, and letting them sit in figuring out their own motives or going to God, versus kind of what you spoke to this, Nick, about not getting caught up in the details of all of the things you've seen and suggesting what you might believe to be an insecurity. So I come to this conflict all this, like in this one situation, like, do I focus on their behavior and let them figure it out, or do I say there might be something underlying and I think it's your insecurity? Like, how do you focus on behavior but not get tied up in the details and fighting over the specific details?
I think I like what Lee said about observing what you see and saying, I'm seeing this and this and this, and here's how it's come across, here's how it's affected me, maybe other people. How about if you...
Can I break in 1 second?
Yeah.
He's noticing... And then he's talking about impact. Notice impact.
So you observe what you see, and then you say the impact. That's what you're highlighting, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you say, so I'm trying to figure out what that means, what to do with that information, you know? And would you be willing to go and think about that, you know? And then, I mean, after that, it's who knows what they're going to come back with, you know? I mean, maybe they're going to come back and say, I don't think there's any problem at all. In which case, I do think sometimes you have to be prepared to say, okay, well, wait. Again, I'm seeing this, and it's coming across this way, and the explanation you just gave me is this. Here's what doesn't quite fit there. Here's what I'm still confused about, you know? Will you go away and think about this a little bit more, you know? And I do think there you can sort of turn up the heat on stuff. And I don't think it's inappropriate sometimes to say, you know, one hypothesis is that you're feeling pretty insecure here, or, you know, or whatever it might be. You can never force somebody to have a conviction about something that you're pretty sure is right. I've had conversations with people where I've been like, look, seems like we're not connecting on this. All I can ask is that you pray earnestly about this, and if you can say before God with a clean conscience, like, there's no problem here, then there's not much else I can do about that, you know? I think depending on what the issue is or how high stakes, like I said, you can turn up the volume on it, get other people involved maybe, but I don't know. I think the approach of notice, impact, and then ask them to go and think about it and come back is pretty effective.
Yeah. I think the term insecurity is a scoundrel. I think it hides more than it reveals. Because if someone appears to be controlling, it's a strategy, right? We don't know what the strategy is intended to accomplish. So I might think it's insecurity, that they have a low view of themselves, or they want stability. I mean, I don't know what the insecurity even means, right? It could be an identity problem. It could be a need to keep things stable. You know, it could be a need for security. It could be a need to be approved of. It could be, I mean, there's so many things it could be. It actually seems to hide more than it shows. And so part of sending someone off to think and pray about it is a lot of times God will reveal where it's coming from. You know, and sometimes I've found that if someone's struggling with an area and they kind of begin to acknowledge it's a problem, like control, I'll ask them, where did you learn to do this? And it'll take them back. Someone modeled it, or someone behaved toward them in a way that this is the only way they could think to solve it, as a kid usually, right? Most of the time when people have behaviors they don't like, well, you're in a situation maybe where they don't see it's a problem yet. But if they begin to see that it's a problem, they will have and be able to develop a really good argument for not doing it. And they'll keep doing it. Because what they don't understand is the really good argument for continuing to do it. They learned this strategy a long time ago, typically. Anger, lying, controlling. They learned this. And if they don't understand what it accomplishes for them, they can't think of a replacement. So part of being patient and letting the Spirit work and listening and trying to follow what the Spirit's trying to do is that He will often lead them to a place where they begin to understand, I learned this to get this done. I learned how to lie so I wouldn't feel shame. I learned how to be angry so I could be heard. I learned how to be angry so I could protect myself. I learned how to control this situation so that I could deal with my anxiety. You don't really know. And the word insecurity sometimes hides so much, it can tempt you to think the answer is insecurity when the answer may be something never even crossed your mind because you weren't with them when they were young.
This is also where the curiosity comes in, and mm-hmm. also where what I'm trying to do here is help a person not get an outcome. So I think that could help too. Once you get a foot in the door to start asking questions, learning.